Welcome back. Andy Burnham has taken up residence in Downing Street as Britain's seventh Prime Minister in a decade. He replaces Keir Starmer, who resigned after the Labour Party's slump in local elections. Burnham pledged to reshape the country's politics and to deliver a new economic model, as well as revive a nation fed up with a revolving door of leaders. Labour lawmakers see Burnham as one of the few figures capable of tackling the threat from veteran Brexit campaigner Nigel Farage's populist Reform UK. A key decision will be Burnham's choice of a finance minister after Rachel Reeves, a Keir Starmer ally, revealed she was leaving the government.
I have just come from Buckingham Palace, where I have accepted His Majesty the King's invitation to form a government. In doing so, I am acutely conscious that I am the sixth person in the last 10 years to walk up this street, the seventh Prime Minister since 2016, making this a moment for reflection and new resolution. It requires my generation of politicians to raise our game and rise to the new challenge. Britain needs to show the world that we can regain our stability once again, and that is our challenge, to make politics work, to make it work better.
All right, Newsroom Africa's correspondent Simon Marks joins us now for more, all the way in London. A very good evening to you, Simon. Thank you so much for your time. So Burnham, in his speech today, used the phrase circuit breaker, and this is in his very first remarks as PM. Beyond the rhetoric, what is the one concrete policy shift that actually breaks from Starmer's approach rather than simply a change in tone?
Well, when he talks, Katlego, about a circuit breaker, he means that he wants to find a way of alleviating economic hardship for some of the country's poorest citizens. And he wants to do that very, very quickly. So he's got all sorts of possibilities, and we won't know the details until he unveils the full plan, but there is talk about raising the threshold at which the lowest paid people in Britain have to start paying income tax. There is talk about possible rent controls being introduced. He wants to take a policy that he implemented when he was mayor of Greater Manchester in the north of the country and cap bus fares at a level of £2 per journey, no higher than that. All of those measures, populist in tone, he thinks are going to deliver what he described today as the breathing room that many people in this country need, because they have assailed the governing Labour Party in those local elections back in May by saying that they simply feel under constant financial stress and pressure. But it's Mr. Burnham who's going to come under stress and pressure now that he's taken over from Sir Keir Starmer in number 10 Downing Street, because the cupboards are bare. The Treasury has not got vast amounts of extra cash to start sloshing around on some of Mr. Burnham's more ambitious plans. He wants, he says, to reverse what he describes as the excesses of Margaret Thatcher's policies back in the 1980s, when nationalised industries were taken into private hands. He wants to re-nationalise some of them. He's talking about re-industrialising the country, turning what is a service economy into a manufacturing economy. And all of that is going to take not only time, but it is going to take money. And the International Monetary Fund, only last week, obviously aware of this change that was going to take place here today, warned Mr. Burnham not to increase public spending, that they are concerned about the debt to GDP ratio that this country is already facing. He's got to deliver economic growth. He hasn't got very long to do it. He has warned his fellow Labour lawmakers that this is the party's last chance if it wants to stop this country from falling into the hands of Nigel Farage and Reform UK. And now he's got to find creative ways of doing all of that within the existing fiscal rules that, of course, had constrained Keir Starmer's government before him.
Mm. And speaking about time, I mean, one thing that really has been reiterated is that revolving door around the prime ministers in the UK, him being the fourth in 5 years and the seventh since 2016. Does that level of turnover undermine his ability to credibly promise a 10-year plan for Britain?
Well, I think that's a really excellent question. I mean, by promising a 10-year plan, he is suggesting that he's going to have 2 5-year full parliamentary terms. And remember that Mr. Burnham walks into Downing Street today without any mandate from the British public. I mean, the only votes that he has won were 25-odd thousand votes in a constituency called Makerfield in Manchester, where he ran for election so that he could get back in to Parliament in order to become Labour leader. And then, of course, he was essentially anointed by the Labour Party. So desperate were they to an alternative to the very technocratic Keir Starmer, a man who many Labour lawmakers had come to conclude lacked just the personality necessary to convey to the British public the achievements that his government had notched up. So Mr. Burnham arrives in power, Mr. Affability, but he doesn't have a mandate. And the question here tonight is, how soon might he call an election? He would be, I think, ill-advised to do it right now, because if an election were held right now, scores of those Labour members of Parliament that are relying on him would lose their seats. Two candidates from the hard right Reform UK party led by Nigel Farage. But if he can find a way of turning public opinion around, and Labour's already enjoyed a 5-point bounce in the polls just as a result of the transition that's taken place here today, then it's perfectly possible that you might see an election in a year's time, certainly earlier than the middle of 2029, when the next election is required to be held. He's going to want at some point to get his own mandate, but he can only do that once he starts delivering.
Mm. And speaking on delivering, I mean, he spoke that his very first instruction would be that of ending rough sleeping. This is backed by an extra £340 million over 5 years. Is that scale of funding realistic against the size of the problem, or is it more symbolic than substantive?
Look, I mean, Andy Burnham is passionate about the issue of homelessness. The first thing he did this morning was to go to a shelter here in London and volunteer and then launch that proposal to, as he puts it, end rough sleeping. If you walk around this city, I mean, the level of homelessness in London is absolutely staggering. Now, he claims that he made progress in Greater Manchester alleviating that particular crisis. That's not entirely backed up by the data, but nonetheless, I think that by identifying this as the first big policy push that he wants to make, he's also drawing a line in the sand. He's saying, look, we just can't continue with the status quo here that is keeping so many people not just sleeping rough on the streets of cities like London, but also keeping so many people out of work as the country's disability welfare budget goes through the roof. He's got to find a way of saving public money in that regard, getting people back to work. I mean, this country has a 16.2% youth unemployment figure. That, by the standards of the G7, is absolutely staggering. And of course, all of those people being out of work, and I know this will be very familiar, of course, in South Africa, they're not contributing taxes. They're not contributing to economic output. Mm. They're not contributing to economic growth. So he's got to come up with policies that he can afford to implement that can deliver demonstrable change. And that's going to be the biggest problem that he faces, especially as he talks about devolving powers out of London to every region of the country. He says he wants to create good growth in every postcode and hope in every heart. And doing both of those things under current circumstances here is going to be a very, very high bar to meet.
Yeah, and he also speaks about putting life's essentials back under public control. And you mentioned earlier what he was talking about, some of the decisions that were made back in the 80s with regards to nationalization and now wanting to reindustrialize. Which sectors do you think would actually be closest to touch? And what would renationalization on any scale cost at Treasury?
Well, I think the first thing he's going to have to confront, and he wants to confront, is one particular water company here. You know, Margaret Thatcher privatized water supply, and there's one particular water company here, Thames Water, that is in terrible, terrible straits and is almost certainly going to be taken back into some degree of public ownership very, very rapidly by Andy Burnham. He's talking about nationalizing the bus companies here in the UK. We don't know the extent to which he wants to go after electricity and gas utilities here. I mean, all of that would be a huge burden on the public purse to bring them back into full public ownership. But if you read Andy Burnham's book, Head North, which he published a couple of years ago, it's a cri de coeur urging the country to correct what he argues were the mistakes of neoliberalism, policies implemented by Margaret Thatcher, the privatization of public wealth. He wants to reverse that, and that is definitely going to be a 10-year plan. But what you don't hear from Andy Burnham is we hear all about reindustrialization and putting people back to work in factories and restoring the economy of the high street in the UK. What we haven't heard one word from Andy Burnham about yet is the AI economy, the innovation economy. There's been very little talk about some of those key sectors that many economists argue are vital to the economies of the 2030s and beyond, as opposed to this idea of reindustrialization in a country where the workforce is just not as cost effective as, for example, workforces in many developing parts of the world that are competing with British labor for jobs. So he's talking about actually now creating a minister for AI that was being floated today. But he's got to show, I think, that he is both not just looking back nostalgically on the past and trying to correct old errors as he sees them, but actually has a sense of how to build the economy of the future.
Simon, before I let you go, I mean, Andy hasn't articulated any extensive views on regions like South Africa, but we do know that British leaders traditionally view South Africa as a vital geopolitical and economic gateway into the continent. What would a leader like Burnham mean to an ordinary South African, especially when he comes in with ideologies around reindustrialization and nationalization?
Look, I think he comes from a wing of the Labour Party that was absolutely viscerally involved in the anti-apartheid struggle. And so he, I think, will be very, very sympathetic to the situation in South Africa, eager to help, very eager as the host of the G20 summit next year, which is going to take place in Manchester, the city where he built his political career. I am absolutely sure he will want South Africa firmly back in the G20 fold, unlike, of course, Donald Trump, the American president, who's going to be hosting the G20 at his own personal golf club this October. So in terms of Andy Burnham giving South Africa a seat back around the table, I think that's not in doubt at all. More broadly in foreign policy terms, I mean, the first two calls he made today were to President Donald Trump and President Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine, respectively. I think you're going to see continuity of policy as far as Britain's support for Ukraine is concerned. He says that he believes that the country has made mistakes. He's apologized for Keir Starmer's handling of British policy towards Gaza. What he's going to do differently in that regard is unclear, but he's definitely coming from a section of the Labour Party that I think many South Africans will find perhaps more palatable than the policies of Keir Starmer broadly.
And lastly, very quickly, what do you think is different about him? Why would this PM be immune to being recalled like his predecessors?
Because he's affable, he's likable. I was talking to one of his close supporters late last week, who had campaigned for Burnham when he tried to win the Labour leadership in 2015, 11 years ago, then had gone to Manchester to campaign for Burnham there. And even he could not tell me what Andy Burnham is going to do in practical policy terms, but absolutely believe that he's got the personality and the affability to win people over. Now, politics, of course, has to be a lot more about just personality. But Sir Keir Starmer was a technocrat who lacked that. It's night and day, given that Mr. Burnham is now in number 10 Downing Street here this evening.
All right, Simon Marks, thank you so much for your time and just unpacking the man, Andy Burnham, for us, who's officially been appointed as the UK Prime Minister.